Welcome to the LGBTQIA+ Fantastica Graphics Digital Symposium podcast series. We hope you enjoyed the series. If you have any comments or questions, drop us a line on our Discord server and join us for roundtable discussions of this series on November the 20th, 2021 via Zoom. For details, go to fantasticajournal.com and select the upcoming events. That's Fantastica with a K. Details are in the podcast info. The discussions are free and open to all, but registration is required for each Zoom panel. There are 5 panels in total.
This podcast is part of Panel 3, Interrogating Space and Place. The Zoom discussion will take place at 3 p.m. GMT time. This podcast is presented by Corey D. Clausen, who is a PhD student in American Studies at Rutgers University, New York. His main research project, archivepelago.org, maps queer artistic influences using digital humanities methods. The project parses archival finding aids for instances of LGBTQIA+ writers corresponding with one another and translating one another's work. His podcast today is entitled Ichthyology of the Closet.
Ichthyology of the Closet. In many respects, one might think of Disney's The Little Mermaid as a significantly queer text, from its queer-coded villain, modeled after drag queen Divine, to the lyrics of producer Howard Ashman, who would lose his sight and his voice ultimately dying of HIV/AIDS-related complications in 1991. However, the affinities between queerness and myths of merfolks do not simply intersect at this cultural moment on the border between the 1980s and 1990s. From Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid and its inspirations such as Undine, to more modern depictions including The Shape of Water, Luca, and The Girl by the Sea, merfolks and other amphibian humanoids have embodied a liminal and queer narrative space. Monstrous in their hybrid appearance and nature, the fish people inhabiting this narrative tradition contend with notions of otherness, belonging and home, desire, and a binary divide between land and sea. Andersen's 1830s short story, originally titled The Daughters of the Air, figures into a mythology that is queer at its core. Just as in Disney's adaptation, the core of the story remains the same. The underwater protagonist experiences an intense curiosity for the surface, ultimately experiencing life as a human through a supernatural pact at the cost of her beautiful voice in order to pursue the love of the prince. As occurs with the Disneyfication of fairy tales, aspects of the original story have been dulled down and made more palatable, particularly the ending, in which the humanized mermaid is faced with the decision between turning to seafoam and dying upon the prince's marriage to another woman, or to kill him with a dagger forged by the sea witch and delivered by her sisters in order to return to her mermaid form. Early in the story, the queen mother, grandmother to the mermaid, serves as an authority, illustrating the binaries of land and ocean by relating the flora and fauna of the shore in relation to those of the sea. This binary extends to the division between merfolks and the humans dwelling on the surface, each with their own habitats and ways of life. I turn now to the work of Eve Sedgwick's Epistemology of the Closet to inspire and propose an ichthyology of the closet, a manner by which we might read through these binaries to understand the inherent queerness of these stories, particularly as they pertain to the acts of identification and outing. Sedgwick categorizes the closet as the defining structure for gay oppression in the 20th century, and argues that categories presented in culture as symmetrical binary oppositions actually subsist in a more unsettled and dynamic tacit relation. The binary of heterosexual-homosexual that Sedgwick deconstructs stands in parallel to that of land and sea, and man and animal in this mythology, as the subjects of these stories attend to their desires and transcend these boundaries. Sedgwick's work specifically attends to sites of definitional creation, violence, and rupture. In texts like Herman Melville's Billy Budd, Andersen's story is, at its core, a story about definitions and divisions. Nowhere is this more clear in the story than the protagonist's pact with the sea witch, who cuts off protagonist's tongue in exchange for a potion derived from the black blood of the sea witch's own breast. Through this cannibalistic act of ingesting the elixir, the mermaid will ultimately rewrite and redefine herself, losing her ability to sing and speak, so that, in the words of the sea witch, her tail would split and contract into what humans call a nice pair of legs, consequently resulting in a feeling as though a sharp sword passed through. Leland G. Spencer has examined this surgical intervention as a trans allegory in performing transgender identity in The Little Mermaid, from Andersen to Disney, which examines themes of mind-body dissonance, familial tension, and self-censorship. The protagonist also trades her 300-year lifespan for an opportunity to gain the prince's affection, facing the possibility of death if he falls in love with someone else. By agreeing to this pact, particularly the excision of her tongue, the mermaid is able to affirm and engage with desire at the expense of speech acts that would further define and perform that desire. As a result, she finds herself ultimately suspended in a friend zone with her beloved prince. He calls her his little foundling, has a man's costume sewn for her so that she could follow him on horseback, and allows her to sleep outside his door on a velvet cushion. It is difficult not to consider her the story of in autobiographical terms, as Andersen himself declared, "The history of my life will be the best commentary of my work." As Jackie Wolfschlager notes in her critical biography of Andersen, the story grew out of Andersen's own experiences of unrequited love and social outsider status. He identified with the tale allying himself in his bisexuality to the mermaid's sense of being a different kind of different species from humankind, and in his position with Edward Cullen, held in affection but never considered as an erotic possibility, and unable to proclaim his feelings, relating her hopelessness for the love of the prince. The pain of unrequited love is performed not just in the form of closed doors and masquerading in the position of male friend. Walking upon her feet causes physical pain. Quote, every step she took was as if she was treading on pointed needles and sharp knives, but she put up with it gladly. With the prince's hand holding hers, she rose as light as a soap bubble, and he and everyone else marveled at her elegant floating walk. Her greatest agony, however, is that of being unable to out herself as his rescuer, as he falls in love with and marries the woman who found him on the shore after the protagonist conveyed him from his wrecked ship, dooming her to melt to sea foam. Despite transcending the binary of land and sea through her transformation, the mermaid can only overcome the torment of unrequited love, unrequited desire in death, without being able to identify and enact speech acts, and to out herself as his true savior from the sea. Sedgwick observes that closetedness itself is a performance initiated as such by the speech act of silence, not a particular silence, but a silence that accrues particularly by fits and starts in relation to the discourse that surrounds and differentially constitutes it. In addition to illustrating the author's own pain of unrequited love, the story illustrates the unbearable subjective experience of being trapped in the closet, presented with the opportunity to end her suffering and return to the status quo by killing the prince. She refuses and ultimately is rewarded. For her selflessness, she again transcends the land-sea binary, becoming a daughter of the air, aligned with the heavens and tasked with doing good deeds for 300 years to earn an immortal soul. The story's transgressions of land and sea, the land-sea binary, present narrative locus for queer identification, as the themes of unrequited love and the shame and secrecy of the closet emerge. Guillermo del Toro's 2017 film, The Shape of Water, in many ways is an inversion of this fairy tale, and similarly situated on the intersection of fantasy, sexuality, and disability. In contrast to Anderson's princess protagonist, the film's main character, Elisa Esposito, played by Sally Hawkins, is a night shift custodial worker at a top-secret government facility in 1960s Baltimore. As an infant, she was discovered near a river with wounds on her neck and mute, communicating only via sign language throughout her life, without parents and other ties, and as a result of her disability, Elisa faces significant isolation, aside from her co-workers, her closeted queer neighbor, Giles, played by Richard Jenkins, who experiences his own isolation, loneliness, aging, a waning career as an artist, is one of the only people in her life. Her life is disrupted upon the arrival of a mysterious creature portrayed by Doug Jones, discovered in a South American river and supposedly regarded as a god by the indigenous people. They develop a relationship as she feeds the amphibian man boiled eggs and plays big band music for him. When Elisa uncovers a cloak and dagger Cold War plot to kill her romantic interest, she develops a plan to liberate him from the facility and release him in a canal connected to the ocean. Plans shift unexpectedly, resulting in Amphibian Man's relocation from the government facility to the bathtub in Elisa's apartment. As the government official, Strickland, ferrets out the creature's location, she cares for him, tenderly salting his water. They grow closer, and their relation extends to the sexual. Amphibian Man displays his supernatural powers, healing Giles after an altercation and restoring the hair he missed enough to purchase a toupee. Warned by her co-worker Zelda that Strickland, vengeful for having lost two fingers to Amphibian Man, and sexually rejected by Elisa, whose mutinous he fetishized, is on his way to the apartment. Giles and Elisa rush to the canal with Amphibian Man to liberate him and provide him passage to the sea. As Elisa and Amphibian Man communicate their goodbyes, Strickland confronts and shoots them, and they fall to the ground and hold one another. Amphibian Man heals himself, confronts and kills Strickland before jumping into the water with Elisa as the police arrive on the scene with Zelda. In the water, he heals her of the bullet wounds and transforms the scars on her neck into gills. The film closes with narration from Giles asserting that the lovers lived happily ever after and loved one another. As they embrace one another in the water, Elisa's transformation into a human amphibian hybrid recalls the thought of Gloria Anzaldúa, who in Borderlands examines the Chicana binaries of U.S.-Mexico, straight / lesbian, man / woman, and woman white / indigenous. In Movimientos de Rebeldía y las Culturas que Traicionan, Anzaldúa describes the shadow beast living inside of her as a rebellious woman taking the shape of a feathered, fanged serpent. Here, Elisa too ultimately embraces her own animality. Anzaldúa discusses the Mita Imita, half and half, a folkloric being that for 6 months she was a woman who had a vagina that bled once a month, and that for the other 6 months she was a man who had a penis and she peed standing up, and asserts that for them abnormality was the price a person had to pay for her or his inborn extraordinary gift. Half and halves are not suffering from a confusion of sexual identity or even a confusion of gender. What we are suffering from is an absolute despot duality that says we are able to be one or the other. It claims that human nature is limited and cannot evolve into something better. But I, like other queer people, am two in one body, both male and female. I am the embodiment of the Eremos Gamos, the coming together of opposite qualities within. By rejecting the duality, the binary of human and animal, and dismissing specious social taboos, Elisa evolves into something queer, having her needs met and her nature affirmed in the process, ultimately leaving behind the solitude and isolation of her life. I turn finally to a brief reading of two 2021 coming-of-age stories that rely upon the hybridity of merfolks. Disney Pixar's Luca and Molly Knox Ostertag's The Girl from the Sea. Both stories are focused on adolescents exploring and coming to terms with their nature, being outed, and the eternal nature of difference. Luca's titular protagonist, like the Little Mermaid, is fascinated by the surface world, and, at least by comparison, is bored with his home life under the sea. He befriends Alberto, another merperson, of roughly the same age, who teaches him about the surface world, including how his own nature to passively shift into human form out of the water and to regain his scales and fish-like features when water touches his skin. The two sea monsters develop a passionate relationship as they explore the seaside village of Portorosso, discovering gelato and bicycles along the way. Animation studies scholar Cody Meyer notes the queer-baiting nature of the relationship between Luca and Alberto. They are inseparable, full of joy, and come to share a dream of owning a Vespa. However, as their adventures come to a close, Alberto remains behind as human friend Julia goes off to school with Luca. Per Meyer's reading, the childish queer pairing is disrupted as Luca's course is corrected. He embraces the defining bookish curiosity that brought him to the surface world as the narrative course corrects with a more suitable narrative pairing. The human protagonist of The Girl by the Sea, the self-conscious and artistic 15-year-old Morgan, is consumed by thoughts of her own future. Her big plans are to get off the island and move to the city, any city, to go to college and to be gay, far away from her tiny town and everyone who's known her since forever. So she reveals in the opening pages of the graphic novel, as she begins to lose consciousness, drowning in the sea. In this scene, moments from death, she is rescued by a mysterious girl with dark, luminous eyes. Much like the mermaid's prince, Morgan comes to the shore, but her half-submerged rescuer sticks around, and they share a kiss. Morgan spends the rest of the narrative navigating her emotions while maintaining a web of lies to preserve the status quo. Her rescuer, Kelty, shows up, announcing that true love's kiss allows her, as a Selkie, to shed her magical skin like a sheet of fabric and walk on land. In order to stay closeted, Morgan isolates herself, pushing away her friends, family, neighbors, and ultimately Kelty, as she insists on following her plan to come out when she leaves the village. Like Amphibian Man, though, Kelty becomes a catalyst, driving Morgan to embrace her queer nature. Her little brother, Aiden, outs Morgan at dinner with her mother and neighbors, Val and Earl, resulting in a cascade of secrets being revealed after her mother consoles her. Who you love is a good thing. It's never a burden to other people. Kelty has come to the village in order to find a way to save the rookery, a habitat for baby seals, by altering the course of a harbor tour run by the parents of Morgan's best friend, Serena. Morgan comes out to her friends and reveals that she is dating Kelty, previously deemed by them as odd. Kelty, who outs herself as a Selkie and forfeits her human form for several years in order to save Serena when she falls into the sea. By the end of the novel, Morgan has largely come to terms with her turmoil, transformed by the experience of a mythological hybrid being entering her life. Luca's ending also engages with notions of secrets and outings. Throughout the film, Alberto and Luca are constantly reminded of the dangers of revealing their true nature via violence-tinged imagery of sea monsters in the village's visual culture and its fishermen inhabitants. However, when a storm cloud erupts as they attempt to finish the third and final leg of a village competition in order to achieve their shared dream of a Vespa scooter, their inevitable transformation into sea monsters leaves the villagers nonplussed. As a pair of village nonas encountered earlier in the film are also revealed to be hybrids as well. The final scene of Ulstertag's graphic novel shares with Luca the notion that queerness has always been present, or at least just beneath the surface, just as the nonas of the seaside village are revealed to be an adventurous pair of sea monsters. In the final scenes of the film, it is revealed that Earl, an elderly neighbor, is a surface-dwelling Selkie. On a walk with Val, his wheelchair-using partner, Earl encounters Morgan plaintively, standing at the top of the hill, looking over her home and the sea surrounding the island. Val offers consolation. The sea, the love of a Selkie, is something special. It comes in like a storm from the sea, all sudden and powerful and impossible to predict, and in its wake, things are changed forever. To which Morgan responds, "She made me want to be more alive, to live all parts of my life." Earl then lowers his glasses, knowingly revealing his luminous eyes. The endings of both of these stories didactically suggest to audiences that queerness and difference are constant, as much as real or literary worlds might seemingly insist on binaries of human and beast, gay and straight, land and sea. Variation and difference often lie on the other side of closet doors.
We hope you enjoyed the discussion of graphic representations of merfolk. This panel will continue with a podcast from Emma French and a discussion of the Dye graphic novels.
If you enjoyed the series or have questions, join the conversation with us on Discord on November the 20th, 2021 for our Zoom webinars. For details, go to fantasticajournal.com and select the upcoming events. The discussions are free and open to all, but registration is required for each of the 5 Zoom panels. We look forward to seeing you there.